Twisted Sisters Crime will contain mature content, graphic descriptions, and violence.
Listener discretion is advised. This podcast may upset trauma survivors.
Say welcome.
Welcome.
To.
Episode.
Four. Crikey, mate! Look at all that crime from down under! Bet it's all those monster spiders that started it!
I like it. Hey guys, welcome to episode 4. We have quite the stories lined up for you today.
So for our stats, I looked at the South Australian Police and they gave a press release updating their crime in the area. According to the December 2020 report that was going over the last 12 months, there were 35 homicides, 18,056 acts intended to cause injury, 2,017 sexual assaults, 516 robberies, and 453 abduction or harassment acts.
Quick plug, make sure that you go to TwistedSistersCrime.com to find all of our social links. We are still selling our merchandise, so let us know if you want a water bottle or to get on list for a shirt.
So with all of that out of the way, let's give Crystal the floor to tell us a fun story.
All right, I'm going to be telling the story of William Terrell. William Terrell was born June 6, 2011. He was 3 when he disappeared from Kendall, New South Wales on September 12, 2014. He had been playing at his foster grandmother's house with his sister. He was also wearing a Spider-Man costume at the time of his disappearance. William is believed to be abducted. So on September 12th, 2016, that was 2 years since he had been missing, they put out a $1 million reward for the recovery of him. They also were not going to require an arrest, charge, or conviction to any person or persons involved in his disappearance.
So, like, the thing that's, like, the statute of limitations has passed or whatever?
I guess.
That's an American thing, but...
Yeah.
That's weird. What year did he disappear?
2014.
So only 2 years later and they're like, we won't convict you?
Yep. They did.
I don't know if they're that desperate or...
I mean,
their
laws are also different than ours in the United States, so I can see that. So we're going to start from the beginning. On September 11th, 2014, William, his foster parents, and his sister went traveling from Sydney, Australia, 4 hours to his foster grandmother's house in New South Wales. Between 10 a.m. and 10:25 a.m. on September 12th, William and his sister had been playing hide-and-seek in the front and backyard with his foster mother and foster grandmother watching them. His foster mother went inside to make a cup of tea. She had become worried after she had not heard from him for 5 or so minutes. It was then she started searching the yard for him. Shortly after, William's foster father came back from Lakewood with a business call that he had to do. William's father began searching the streets and knocking on neighbors' doors. It wasn't until 10:56 a.m. William's foster mother called 000, that's the emergency services in Australia, to report him missing.
I feel like that's easier than 911.
I mean
that's saying
three
something,
digits,
but you have to go 9 and then up. And then you just go 000. Like, I feel like it could be faster.
True.
Freaking America, why do we have to suck in everything?
I don't know. The police arrived at 11:06 a.m. His foster mother remembers the last words were him roaring like a tiger and running towards the side of the house.
Okay, I'm gonna cry.
I know. This is sad. This is such a sad story.
So how old was he? Did you already say that? Am I stupid?
He was 3. So that's my son's age.
I know, because as soon as you said he was wearing a Spider-Man outfit, I'm seeing him, and now I'm going to cry.
I know. It's a sad story.
I can't even imagine.
Oh, being a mother of a 3-year-old, I never let my 3-year-old out of my sight. I can't.
Ugh.
Hundreds of police, members of state emergency services, rural fire services, and members of the community searched day and night for William. Specialty police, including sex crime squads from the strike force, were immediately informed. Motorcycles, helicopters were all brought in to help with the search. And 200 volunteers searched overnight. Hundreds of people combed rugged terrain around the home, and police divers searched waterways in the dams. The police searched every house in the estate that surrounds his foster grandmother's estate. Police detection dogs were sent out, and they did manage to get William sent, but it was only within the boundaries of the backyard, meaning that William would have had to been taken by a car or a vehicle for them not to pick up his scent after that. Mm-hmm. After about 5 days, the police could not come up with any leads on his disappearance. The police did later begin investigating two cars that had been parked at the dead end of the street near William's grandmother's house. The cars were described as a white station wagon and a gray sedan. They had been noticed by William's mother and had not been seen since William's disappearance. Now, this information was not given out to the public until at least 12 months after William had been disappeared. So the police did know this information, but they didn't put it out to the public until a year after he was missing. Interesting.
I mean, it's
they
like,
must do something differently in Australia that we don't know the laws to.
Yeah, because it's like they don't want to release so much that their case is, I can't remember the exact wording, but like the case is tainted or something.
Right.
Where it's ruined because there's so much information they can't prove that this person did it because they know details only police would know. But something like a car, you'd think would be easy for the public to be like, oh, that's my great uncle Joe's car. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's just they didn't have like anything else.
I know.
I just sometimes I wish I could understand like what exactly was going in the minds of the cops at that time, you know?
Me too.
It's wild.
It is wild. So the police did rule out William's family from any involvement. They suspected he might have disappeared by a stranger who may have had involvement in a pedophile ring. The police also did believe William could be alive at this time. The police interviewed dozens of people, including a number of pedophiles. There were at least 20 registered sex offenders also living within the surrounding area of where William had gone missing. None had any involvement with William's case. More than 1,000 sightings had been reported in 2 years after William disappeared. Now, this is where things kind of get a little interesting and crazy. And
jumbled.
A guy named Ray Porter, he was a dying man, told one of his nurses that he didn't hurt that young boy. And his nurse asked if he meant William Terrell, and Mr. Porter did say yes. So according to Ray Porter's statement, he picked up the boy and his friend Frank Abbott, who was a known sex offender and serial killer in that area, and drove them 300 kilometers north. After Ray told the nurse this confession, people from the town did recall and remember overhearing Frank Abbott saying the police are not looking in the right place for this young boy's body. Mr. Porter is now deceased, but again, the sources are not confirmed. Also, according to News 7, in March 2020, William Terrell had been found in a suitcase, but still nobody has been convicted of William's disappearance. I haven't found any other information from police or news articles confirming or denying this. There also is a lot of conflicting resolutions that William has been found, and also that the Spider-Man suit that was found near the suitcase could have been planted by the police. According to TheGuardians.com, this is still an open case. So, yeah.
That's so sad.
It's a very sad story. And I picked it because I do have a 3-year-old So I wanted to kind of just bring awareness to people that we're in a scary time in our lives, not just with COVID and these zombies coming out, you know, that you need to just take care and watch your kids. Cause I don't know.
It can happen in the blink of an eye.
And I never realized that until I had my own child. Mm-hmm. Like, I had worked daycare tons of times and taken my eye off of a kid for a second and they fell and got hurt, you know. The same thing happens when it's your own child. Yeah. So, yeah.
It's so sick that people out there take advantage of that. Because you can't sit there and stare at your child all day.
You can't.
It's
exactly.
not physically possible.
Exactly. I would be at the park with my son and look at my phone for the split second, and then I lose him for 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And your heart just drops.
Yeah.
Like, so I totally understand what this, his foster mother had to have felt.
Yeah. Dang, that's rough.
It's a rough story.
All right, so mine is about the Beaumont children. So January 26th of 1966, which was Australia Day, Jane, who was 9, Arna, who was 7, and Grant, who was 4, took a bus to Glenelg Beach in Adelaide from their house in Somerton Park. They went on a bus after asking their mother, Nancy Beaumont, for permission. They went unsupervised, but this was common for them. The bus ride for them was only 5 minutes, and in 1966, Australia was still considered very safe, and many children actually had the free-range upbringing. And so, this is the log of the day that we know of. On 8:40 a.m., the children left for the beach. On 8:45, the children got on the bus. 12 p.m., the first bus came to Glenelg Beach and left without the children. 2 p.m., the last bus came back to Somerton Park and the children were still not on that bus. So at that point, Nancy Beaumont began freaking out a little bit. So then at 3 p.m., Grant Jim Beaumont returns home from work and immediately drives to the beach to start to search for them. At 5:30, Grant and Nancy notify the police. At 7:20 p.m., the children were officially declared missing by Glenelg Police. At 8:40 p.m., police searched the Brighton Shore, West Beach, and Henley Beach. At 9:50, Sea Rescue Squad volunteers searched the coastline on their own accord. And at 10 p.m., the father, Grant, reports that he spoke with his friends and relatives in the area and no one saw the children. The father asked for the police to give a radio public announcement. So then following the next few days, the police started searches, at first believing that the children were just lost. Then they expanded to the airport and interstate roads, fearing that they were kidnapped. At first, they decided to give a reward of 250 Australian pounds if anyone had information about them. None of the children's individual items they took to the beach with them were found, like their towels, sunscreen, water, like none of that was found. I think they had 17 items that they had brought with them, I read somewhere.
Okay.
The days following, the Glenelg Police Station had people lined up to give statements, and the largest search party until then in South Australia's history was developed. Multiple people reported seeing the children around the beach with a tall, blonde, thin-faced man in his 30s. And they were confirmed to have been seen at Coley Reserve and at Wenzel's Cake Shop on the Mosley Street. So these are the other confirmed sightings. A woman said she saw the children between 11 to 12 p.m. run from the ocean and lay out on their towels before running under sprinklers to clean off. She also stated she saw this thin-faced suspect on a nearby towel eyeing the children. She then saw the children walk over and start to play with the suspect. Another female stated that she also saw that at 11:30 a.m. the children were playing in the sprinklers. Later on, a couple was approached by the man and asked if they saw anyone with their clothes and claimed that money had been stolen from them. This couple then witnessed him walk back, dress the children, and lead them away to some changing sheds about 130 meters from where they were playing. At 12:15, they saw the children and the man walk towards the bus stop. A worker at Wenzel's Bakery said that Jane had bought a meat pie, 5 pastries, 6 finger buns, and 2 bottles of fizzy drink at 12:30 p.m. This was strange because she paid with a pound when her mom had only given her 6 shillings and 6 pence to pay for treats. Scott Russell...
So Jane is the oldest, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So she had to have gotten this money from this man, right?
Yeah, that's what I think they're trying to insinuate.
Okay.
Is that she obviously was with someone who gave her extra money. And
right.
She never... I guess they would go to the beach a lot. Like, it was common for them. And the guy that worked there said she never, ever bought a meat pie and that much food. Like, she usually only bought, like, each of them a pastry and drinks. She never bought that much.
Okay. So,
Scott Russell Hill said that his father swears that he saw the children on the corner of Augusta and Durham Streets at 1:30, although this is one of them that is not confirmed. This father and Scott knew the children very well. He even claims that he found other people around the area that saw the children at that same time. 3 p.m. on Jetty Road, the postman saw the children holding hands and laughing, although he stated that it may have been actually that morning he saw the children and all that, not that afternoon. He can't really remember. So I'm going to show you this picture. Okay. I'm going to put it on the blog for those of you who aren't physically here.
Perfect.
So here is Glenegg Beach, this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the bakery was at the time. It's been moved since. I think now it's over here somewhere. That's the beach house. So that's where the changing rooms would have been. And then this is the Collie Reserve, where they said was one of their last known sightings. So they stayed pretty much there. And after that, no one really saw them.
Okay.
So 3 days later, on January 29th, a woman told police she had spoken to what she believed to be the 3 children near Patalonga Boat Haven at 7 p.m. the day they disappeared. So the police drained this haven but found nothing. On November 8th of 1966, Jared Corsat, who was a psychic from the Netherlands, came to Australia to aid with the case. His stories, however, kept changing and he couldn't find any solid clues. He did say that there was a warehouse near the children's homes and their primary school that he believed they were buried in, since the site was under construction when they went missing. The public then raised $40,000 to have the building demolished to check for the bodies. No remains or evidence was found. So here is this. So it's somewhere in this area that the warehouse is, because that was their school and that was their house. But this is up here is where the beach was.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's quite a drive back for him to put their bodies there, but...
Okay.
Whatever you want.
So the psychic didn't, like, actually...
No.
...check out in a way because...
His stories kept changing, and every time they tried to find clues, it didn't work out. So...
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't really help, but it was part of it, so...
Okay.
I had to tell it.
Cool.
So 2 years later, the Beaumont parents actually received 2 hoax letters. The first was apparently written by Jane, and the second was apparently written by the man who had kidnapped them. At the time, they did compare Jane's letter to her handwriting that they had at home and assumed that they were authentic. She described a pleasant experience with what was quoted as the man. The letter by the man said that he had made himself their guardian and was willing to return the children and made a meeting place. The parents then drove with a detective to the meeting place, but no one showed up. A third letter came, apparently from Jane, stating that the man saw the detective and left. In 1992, so kind of like 20 years later-ish,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Forensic examinations occurred over these 3 letters and determined them to be hoaxes. They found it matched a 41-year-old man who had been a teenager at the time. He, however, was not charged since so much time had passed since the initial incident. So this is when things get fun. We have like a million suspects. So Bevan Spencer von Enem, he murdered a 15-year-old named Richard Kelvin in 1984. He was known to go to Glenegg Beach to watch children in the changing rooms. Informant Bob O'Brien, who aided in the case of Kelvin, said that he heard Bevan boast about taking three children from a beach and taking them home to experiment on them. He claimed that he performed surgery on them, in which one of the children died, so he killed the other two and dumped the bodies in a bushland. However, at the time, he would have only been 20 to 21 years old, so he wouldn't have matched that description. So Arthur Brown was charged in 1998 with the murders of the McKay sisters. Many people came forward in the 1980s claiming that Arthur Brown had molested them and taking them to the same creek bed that the McKay bodies were found. Because of his dementia and Alzheimer's, he did die on July 6th of 2002 and never got convicted for the McKay children, rape of six children, and also the sexual assault of 45 victims. James O'Neill told a station owner in Kimberley that he was the one who abducted the Beaumont children. A documentary was titled The Fisherman and it aired on October in 2006 that attempted to link him to the case. In 1971, O'Neill was charged with 12 offenses. In February of 1975, he abducted and killed Ricky John Smith, and after interrogation, he led police to his body. And I actually have a picture on the blog that shows him literally pointing to where the kid is. It's kind of creepy.
Dang.
He pled insanity at trial due to a head injury from a gunshot accident in 1969 at work. Gordon Davey interviewed O'Neill for hours and didn't believe a word he said, thus making the fisherman. He claimed that he never went to Adelaide and he could not have taken the Beaumont children, but according to his work in the opal industry, he would have had to pass through multiple times. In the early 1970s, O'Neill did, however, tell people he was responsible for the Beaumont disappearances. South Australia police did interview him and discounted him as a suspect. Then we have Derek Ernest Percy, who was Victoria's longest-serving prisoner at the time. He had a psychological condition that prevented him from remembering details of his actions. He suggested that he could have been responsible for the Beaumont children, as he was in the area at that time, but he couldn't remember it. He would have only been 17 at the time, and he didn't have a car with him, which was a necessity for the suspect to have a quick getaway and a way to dispose of his bodies. And he died in July of 2013. Now we have Alan Maxwell McIntyre, who claimed that a man named Alan Anthony Monroe had come to his house in 1966 with the children's bodies. Monroe had already pled guilty to 10 child sexual offenses in and around South Australia. There is a children's diary also placing him around Glenick Beach at the time of the disappearance, but there are no other evidence saying that Alan Anthony Monroe had committed this crime, and he died in June of 2017. Our last suspect is Harry Phipps, who was a factory owner in Adelaide. A book in 2013 called The Satin Man, Uncovering the Mystery of the Missing Beaumont Children, made Phipps' estranged son identify Harry Phipps as a Satin Man. At the time of the disappearance, he did resemble the police sketches and was known to have pedophile tendencies. He also lived only 300 meters from Glenick Beach. In 2007, Hayden, who was the son of Harry Phipps, came forward claiming he saw the bodies of the children in the yard that day. Two other children also claimed that they were paid by Phipps to dig a hole in his factory yard that same weekend. Following this and the Satin Man book allegations, in November of 2013, police excavated 1 meter square of his factory, but there was no evidence found and the site was officially closed. In January of 2018, they returned again and excavated more of the factory, but only found animal bones and garbage. According to SA Major Crime Superintendent Des Bray, Phipps has over 30 circumstantial evidence items tying him to the Beaumont case. There is still a possibility that he is involved, having a cottage at the factory that was off limits to everyone but him, that he could have hosted the children's bodies before he disposed of them, either in a sand pit or a furnace that he had access to. However, Harry Phipps did die in 2004. The last update on this case was in 2018 when police raised the reward to $1 million for any other information regarding the case. As for the parents, the couples did separate in the 1980s and later divorced. Nancy just died in September of 2019, and Grant Jim is still alive in his 90s. Neither ever had any more children.
So even in 2018, you know, they were still, like, looking into this Harry Phipps guy.
Mm-hmm.
And
so they still just don't know who could even have done it. It's been 55 years. And they still haven't found their bodies. They have a lot of people they're looking at. But most of them are dead at this point, so...
Well, guys, I think that's all we have for you today. So, tune in next week. We'll have an awesome episode for you.
Yep, and as always, all of our sources and pictures and all that jazz will be on our blog at twistedsisterscrime.com. And then, of course, we have our Instagram and Facebook pages up. So other than that, I think there's nothing else to say other than stay smart, stay safe, and stay twisted.
Thanks, guys.